You are listening to Syndicated Thursday on Hacker Public Radio. Each Thursday we highlight a Creative Commons work, and today it's Geek Nights. In this episode they talk about Git, the fast version control system. The technical discussion begins about 30 minutes in.
It's Monday, August 1st, 2011. I'm Rim.
I'm Scott.
And this is Geek Nights. Tonight, Git.
Let's do this.
Started my new job today.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty great, I gotta say. I was... You know,
any new job is great on the first day. I could start working at McDonald's. It'd be great on the first
day. You know, when I started at that hospital, the first day, a lot of warning signs that
really?
Things were not so great.
I've never seen warning signs
warning
on day
sign
one.
The first when I started that hospital, like 6 years ago. One, they gave me an alphanumeric pager.
Oh, boy.
And I was like, what's this? And they were like, it's your pager. And I was like, yeah, that's never getting turned on. Warning sign the second. Firefox not installed on the desktop, and I didn't even know how to get it installed.
Okay.
Warning the third, couldn't get to slash dot, blocked.
You know, before I work somewhere, I ask if they filter internet or anything like that.
Oh, I normally do, but I didn't back then. That was a long time ago.
I've done that even before I graduated college. I was like, do you filter internet? Yeah, I'm not working there. Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah, but no, it's pretty great to be, I don't know, this is a big step up. I'm the vice president of product management. So.
Yeah, but you're only the vice president of like 10 people.
Well, it's more that
there's only 10 people there.
People actually listen to what I say. So it's not like think
that
about
is,
Kineticon.
That is a key difference.
Think about Kineticon when we're like, here's the obvious smart thing to do. And then we got to like fight for stuff. I can be like, this is the smart thing to do. And people are like, all right.
Are you describing some sort of non-existent utopia? What are the people, you say something and people listen like, hey, yeah, it'd be a really good idea if we switched from Exchange to Google Ads.
You know what's even better? If I'm wrong or my idea is bad, smart people intelligently disagree.
Oh my God.
It's kind of crazy.
Are you sure this is a real workplace?
Watch, I never get a paycheck. I show up one day and there's like cardboard cutouts of everyone.
That's the thing is like some recruiter just called me and I was like giving him the shit. You know, just, I'm like, whatever.
Oh, recruiters?
Happen to call me while I'm waiting for Rim to show up and I have nothing better to do. I'll talk to you because you have the balls to call me on the phone instead of just emailing.
The last recruiter I talked to, he emailed me and he was like, yeah, what do you want? I got this like Linux system administration job. And I was like, I need 300K before I even am going to look
yeah.
at this.
So I'm just like treating the guy like crap. Like, yeah, what do you make if I get hired? He's like 25%. I'm like, oh, you told me. That's not bad.
Yeah.
No, but the thing was, is like, you know, there's always I always get these things from startup places, you know?
And oh, they're like, I can gladly pay you Tuesday in stock options.
Exactly, right? It's like startups, they really want to get you in because it's basically impossible to hire tech people.
But they're paying you nothing.
I
they're
have
like,
rare,
look,
rare skills.
Like you, I think you said it best. I'm going to give you this pile of lottery tickets coupled with a pittance of a salary.
But you get to work in a party zone.
But also 80-hour weeks.
Also 80-hour weeks in the party zone. And we'll give you lottery tickets.
Oh, other utopias, right? You know what my work hours are? Get the work done.
Nice.
Yeah.
Excellent day. That's
like the big ups ride their bikes to work. It's got like all the
How
fun
old
stuff.
Are the big ups?
Standard big up age.
What kind of?
But all the people around, like at my level and under, are our age or younger. Like they're actually, and they're all smart. And
all
this
right,
company is like, yeah, interns, yeah, co-ops. Let's
here's
go.
Here's how we really know the three important questions to tell if these are big ups or good or not. You ready? Question number one: what phones do the big ups have?
I actually don't know. But, okay. But they asked me what phone I had because they were going to give me a company phone, and I filled out the Nexus, and everyone's like, oh, you don't need our phone.
Okay. Two, what computers do they have on their desk?
Everyone has a different computer. One guy has a super fast Mac. Bunch
like the
of
the tower?
Or
a MacBook Pro?
One has a MacBook Pro, one has a tower.
Whoa, someone has the Mac Pro tower?
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, people, like, the first computer they gave me before I got the Windows box was just Ubuntu.
Okay. There's already an Ubuntu in the house.
Yeah?
That's a good sign. Okay, question number three. This is the most important.
Uh-oh.
What kind of bikes are they riding?
Actually, he's got one of those commuter bikes.
Oh, the foldy Dayon
yep.
thing?
Yep.
Okay. That's a very
but
CEO kind of bike.
The thing is, they know real bikes, and they're all super athletic, which counts for a lot, actually.
Yeah, but the question, you know, if it was like...
I'm tired of working with Unix Santas. As much as I love Unix Santas, I like people I can play paintball with.
The thing is, the ideal company, right, has to have both. You have to have the Unix Santa.
You don't need the Unix Santa if there's no Unix in your job.
If there's no Unix, then you got another problem. Because
well,
pretty much every server
lot.
Should be Unix.
Here's the weirdest
kind.
Thing. This is the first time in my life I've had a job where my job does not in any way involve straight up support.
But I mean, your company uses Unix machines. You have servers.
Well, yeah, there's stuff. But
right.
I don't have to manage that. I'm actually kind of divorced from that like operational tech.
Right, but the point is...
I've done operations my whole life.
You got to have Unix Santas and Steve Jobs's combined, right? Because while lately I've been a lot of my rants and technical opinions have been very anti-Jobs, you got to remember that the Jobs is also necessary,
well,
right?
Let's put it this way. The Jobs made, for whatever you feel about Apple... some of the best goddamn user interfaces the world has ever seen.
Yeah, some. Not
some,
all.
Some.
Right.
But the
but look, you know, take for example, my favorite example I always bring up in this discussion is the Apple II GS, the most beautiful computer ever created.
That's Unix Santa.
Why was the Apple II GS created? It was because it was a combination of Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs.
Scott,
if you just had the Wozniak without the Jobs, the Apple II GS would have been like all sorts of wicked ugly. If you just had the Jobs, you wouldn't have been able to open it. It would have been welded shut, right? But because you had both, you had this perfect computer that opened up just once, and it was completely flat, and all the slots were in a row. It was the ultimate combination.
I feel like
Unix
there's a third
Santa.
Way. There's a third way. There's actually a triangle.
What's the third way?
You've got Unix Santa, Steve Jobs, and the other direction is Tim Berners-Lee. Idealized software solutions.
Anyway.
Functional requirements with no interface or thought for practicality.
Right. So speaking of Steve Jobs, right, you got a new HDVC.
I did.
Which
I
is
have
not that exciting.
I have not plugged it into my TV yet just because I've been busy. But
yeah, it works though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? My whole life, ever since I switched away from AMD, I got to say, I've never had a failure to post on the first boot. In fact, I... closed the case and put all the screws in before I turned it on for the first time. That is how fucking confident I was.
And you were right.
Dude, my old AMD boxes, I would like plug power into the motherboard with CPU and RAM sitting on the floor and turn it on to make sure it worked.
Can't go wrong with NVIDIA Intel. Anyway, you didn't need the Mac Mini anymore.
No.
So I said, hey, Mac Mini... You have served your many years. That's actually many years old.
Oh my God. It was a Core Solo. It's the
you, do you remember that you originally bought it?
To replace my normal PC.
To use as your normal PC, and it was in the earliest days of Geek Nights.
You may remember an episode that was me bitching for an hour because I unplugged my old computer, which was my old RIT computer. It was like a Thunderbird gigahertz.
So this was probably in 2005, 6, right?
I remember there's a picture of me sitting there like holding it up, like amazed at how tiny it is, and I install it.
I think it was actually 6, 7, but that's
I set it up, and I'm like, I still had that old 19-inch CRT.
Yeah.
And... it was so shiny and so nice, and then I opened up GarageBand, and I was like, let's podcast, and then 4 hours later, I had plugged my old PC back in. It wouldn't boot because it was broken. That's the reason I replaced it, yeah. And I redid an entire episode from scratch that was me bitching about how much I hate the Mac.
All right. So this Mac Mini, I said, well... you have lived out your years. If we threw you out or just sold you or gave you away, that would not be bad, but... you still work, and you're a Mac. You're the only Mac I have that's not a work computer that I can't use for personal things.
I have some trouble with the optical drive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I brought it home to. I said, why not? I'll try some development of iPhone app. I'll make the simplest iPhone app that's like just a fucking button or something.
Dude, the thing's
just
so
to
old,
make an iPhone app.
Do you notice how the Apple logo at the top, like that's plastic, is slightly yellowed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, I brought it home, and I wanted to reinstall the Snow Leopard to get it back to nothing. And I couldn't because the optical drive was busted, which I remembered.
It works okay. Though watch out, we switched it to region 2. You'll have to...
It doesn't matter because I'm not even going to use the optical drive. I went and I used my work Mac to create a Snow Leopard bootable USB stick, which,
nice.
Which worked amazingly. If you search on Google for directions, it'll tell you how. It worked perfectly. So I reinstalled the Snow Leopard from the USB stick. Beautiful. Then I said, well... Let me get the Xcode. So there's a free Xcode in the App Store, Xcode 4.1, which is the newest one. You need Lion. Alrighty. What's only $30? Who gives a shit? I'll buy your stupid Lion. You cannot install Lion. You have a Core Solo.
That's so sad.
Which is not 64 bits.
That's so sad.
Oh, well then. Let me go get Xcode, because you remember there was Xcode 3.something, which is on the Snow Leopard disk, so I could have just installed that easily. But before they came out with Xcode 4.1, there was Xcode 4.0, which is the one that they were charging like $10 for in the App Store. Remember that? When everyone was like, oh, they're charging for Xcode $10, so now it's free again. Well, I said, well, let me go get that one that they were charging $10 for, right? Well, it wasn't in the App Store, so I went to the Apple developer site. And it wasn't there. The only ones they had were 4.1, which is the one you need Lion for, and 3.something, which is the one I already had on the USB stick. So I'm like, what happened to 4.0 point whatever? You need to pay $100 to be in the iOS developer program to get that.
Oh, my God.
And the iOS, you can't even, if you had Lion, you could make all the iPhone apps you wanted. But you can't load them onto your iPhone unless you pay the $100.
That sounds
about
right.
And you can't submit them to the App Store unless you pay $100.
That sounds about right.
You can only run them in the little emulator. And by the way, that $100 is $100 a year, not $100 once. It's $100 a year to be an iOS developer.
Still going
to
be an iOS developer?
Fuck no. Giving that Mac Mini to the parents to use as an HTPC and to sync their iPods. Because right now...
Watch out. It won't full screen 1080p.
It doesn't matter. They're my parents. They can't even watch Netflix on their TV right now.
Dude, you think they're going to be okay with control zooming in to YouTube videos like we were?
They're not going to watch YouTube videos. They're just going to use like Boxy and watch... We're lucky if they use Boxy to watch a Netflix. All right? That'll be a huge improvement over what they're doing now.
Boxy didn't even work so well on that thing.
It's better than what they have now. At the very least, right? They don't even have like a Ubuntu on a Dell laptop that they use for everything. And all they really do is use Firefox, which is just fine for them. But they have iPods that they can't sync. So at the very least, they can just use it for iTunes and nothing else, which it can definitely do.
Yeah.
On Snow Leopards.
I think in the long run, it should probably replace the, like, I don't know, put it somewhere in their house as like a little PC somewhere.
I don't know. But yeah, I'll just give it to them because now it's useless for me. But the thing is, I have to go and buy them the little Mac keyboard that goes with it.
No, yeah, because I kept that one.
Yeah.
Because I like the Boxy remote, but since I need a mouse anyway for when I'm not in Boxy.
Yeah. I've been using Boxy more, though. I've got it hooked up to pretty much all the video files, so...
Yeah, I just...
Anytime I want to watch it, the only time I don't use Boxy is pretty much to go to College Humor.
Yep.
And Cinemasker.
I got to see what it would take to set up, like, a Boxy app thing that would just do College Humor.
You want to... Oh, there is a College Humor Boxy app, but it only watches College Humor originals. It doesn't do all the videos
in order.
Come
on, College Humor. What the fuck?
Yeah. You can write a Boxy app in Python if you want.
Really? That's what I was about to ask. What does it take? Is it easy to do that? Because...
There's instructions on the Boxy website. You can just write Boxy apps. It's actually not that hard.
Duly noted.
You know, you could definitely do it. Your code might be ugly, but you could definitely write a Boxy app.
Yeah, because I need a Python project, and while I like web stuff, and like I was playing with Django, and I really like Flask. I was playing with that. That's really fun, actually.
Flask is a lot simpler.
It's really fun, because if I want to...
But the thing is, what's going to happen is, I've used Flask a bunch also.
Yeah.
You start using it, you're like, whee! And then you want to do something like logging in. And it's like, you can write a login authentication thing, or... Django has authentication. You don't have to do anything. So
no, what I would use Flask for in my professional life, in the like operations, is something like making a little status page of stuff.
Absolutely perfect use of Flask.
Yep. Like, see what's running on the PC. Use it, you know, anything like that. But it's just fun, too, because, you know.
You just got to make sure you put the Apache and the WSGI in front of it properly. You know how to do that?
Yeah.
I can show you how to do that.
I learned how to do that.
Okay.
Because I had a lot of free time recently. Because
that way you can get things like the Apache auths and
but
all that crap.
As much as
that's something I got to tell you. I'm not going to go into this very long. You know the Apache configs? There's always like allow, deny, allow from, all that business.
Yeah, yeah.
I mastered that.
Really?
Yep.
It's not that hard.
I've completely mastered all that. I finally know what it all means and can do it perfectly.
Can you? Here's the love. This is if you're like a 4 out of 10 in terms of guru mastery of Apache.
All right.
Do you know how to pretty much drop in, make Apache Authenticate against an Active Directory like a Windows one?
I already saw the instructions.
Yeah. Have you ever done it?
No.
I'm just curious.
No. But I could. If I had to do it, I could do it in a day, probably.
Yeah, because I did it, but it didn't work with Twiki, and then I gave up.
What I did, actually, at work, is I made it so that if you visit a page, a site, on a virtual host, actually, it gives you basic auth, which is, you know, username and password, against an HD password file. But if you're coming from a certain IP, no basic auth. You just get right in. So if you're in the office, you can just visit the page. But if you're outside the office, you got to log in to get the page.
I did the same thing. I had a thing that would control some fixed sessions on this like fixed gateway I wrote.
Right.
And it had a little like web page in it that would like you could like turn sessions on and off and whatever. And I didn't want to put auth into it because I didn't care.
Right. So anyway, the end of this opening bit is fuck you, Steve Jobs. You want people to make iOS apps. You should let people develop them on Windows or whatever. I might try this PhoneGap thing, which came out with 1.0 today, which lets you make an app in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript that will then work on Android, iPhone, Windows Phone, and fucking everything.
Yep.
So I'm going to try that out.
I thought, oh, we should make a Geek Nights app. Then I was like, what the fuck would it do?
Nothing.
Yep.
If you want a Geek Nights app, what you can do is you can use your Twitter and soon your Facebook app on whatever device you have and just go to us in Twitter or Facebook. And
yep.
That's basically the equivalent of the app, is you'll get all the notifications about all our new shit.
Yep. And our, well, I'll save it for the meta. I got some meta moments.
You can go to frontrowcrew.com in your mobile browser.
So let's talk about some tech, because there was I had some other news I wanted to talk about, but I noticed this article today. It's funny, having a job where it's really knowledge-based and not operational at all, and also, you know, learning a lot. I didn't look at the internet, like, once the whole time I was at work.
Well, you never look at the internet on your first day.
Warning sign, that hospital, 2 hours looking at FARC because no one would, like, meet with me to tell me what to do.
Whoa. So even you didn't even have a full day of HR papers to fill out?
No, actually, today, 5 minutes of HR, because it's an LLC.
Nah.
So it's like, bam!
Nice.
Plus, you know, I'm older now. I'm smarter. I know what to expect. So I came in with my passport, a canceled check, you know, all the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't do that, you know, the last time I took a job.
I always forget the canceled check. That's the one I forget.
Yeah, I remember it because I changed jobs. This is, you know, you changed jobs a while ago. I hadn't changed jobs in like 4 years. I was waiting for this day.
You're waiting for You remembered it better because it was longer ago.
Yeah. Well, I thought back. I was like, what went wrong the last time I got a job? The problems I had were I didn't know anyone's phone numbers for like the beneficiary stuff. I didn't even know my mom's address. I had to go like look it up.
I always need my the beneficiary social security numbers.
Yeah. That's... I didn't need that yet because, well, anyway.
Anyway.
Yeah. But so there's this article from today about some CMU researchers, Carnegie Mellon, by the way, which is...
Yeah, we know what that is.
Some people might not.
Almost went there.
I run into people, I'm like, RIT. They're like, yeah, RPI. I'm like, no, RIT. RPI sucks. But CMU is a good school, and they came up with a pretty... This is one of those things where like, hey, let's see if we can do it. And the fact that what they did as quickly and kind of half-assedly, hackishly as they did, worked as well as it did, is kind of... It's not scary to me, because I knew, but it might be scary to your mom. With crappy off-the-shelf webcams and fairly simple data mining of like Facebook,
okay,
they were able to make a system where if you point a webcam at a crowd and it sees people's faces, it'll find their social security numbers.
Yeah, that could work. Because you get the face, you match the face up with Facebook.
You get profile information.
You get the name, address, whatever, and then you look, you basically get as much information as you can.
Now here's where the kicker.
Starting
with
Facebook, or starting with Flickr, or Picasa.
They just did Facebook, apparently, to start.
And then you start with just Facebook.
Now here's the thing, here's the kicker.
And you just cross-reference, and if enough things match, you can just, on different sites you go to, you can just keep filling out the profile until eventually you hit a site that has a social security number, and you've got the whole profile.
Granted, that site is breaking the law.
Well, duh.
But here's the kicker. The thing that made this probably a lot easier. I didn't go into the depth of how they did it, like on the low level. But to this day, 4 digits of my social security number are in all my old RIT shit.
Yeah, a lot of times I imagine that like if they could get 80% of the real full numbers, they could definitely get 99% of the last 4 digits.
And here's the funniest part. 60% of the students that they caught didn't have social security numbers. So it was crazy successful despite the fact that the majority of the people they were testing did not even have them. So it got some crazy percentage of the people who did.
Mm-hmm.
So what this illustrates is something we talk about, or we have talked about a lot. I think we've talked about it recently, that there's a lot of publicly available but difficult to get information. Like, if you really want to stalk one person, this is what PIs used to do. A private investigator just gets publicly available information. It's not a crime to stand on the sidewalk and look at someone's house. Not a crime to just follow someone unobtrusively. Not a crime to take a picture of stuff in public places, go to public records, Freedom of Information Act stuff. Technology allows you to do that to everyone all the time at zero cost.
Yep. Almost zero cost.
Effective, negligible cost.
Yes.
Couple this with the fact that there are
negligible cost per person. To actually do it to everyone at once, you do need to buy a bunch of computers. Your cost per person will be zero, but the cost of a rack will be like a couple thousand a month.
Well, like, think of this. A lot of people are afraid of Google Maps and Google Street View. And
that's
actually
the least of your worries.
I don't think Google should even be blurring out faces or anything.
I don't understand the license plate thing. That's always really confuses me.
Yeah, but that aside, all Google did was economy of scale and had people basically do the equivalent of walk around and take a picture of everything.
Yep.
And
they're actually, I wish they would do, I heard that a while ago, like months and months ago, that they were going to go into stores and take pictures in the stores if the stores let them.
That would be so awesome.
Right, but I haven't actually seen that on any street views yet. So I'm still been waiting for them to like announce that they've added that. Like, if I could go and look in the bodega to see if they have, you know,
I'd go one step further. Here's a way for Google to actually make some money.
Yep.
Like a product. What they could sell is a service where if you have an event, like a convention, you can pay them to send someone, probably just someone they hire, like a contractor who uses their technology, who goes into the event for, you know, repeatedly walking around, gathering like these gigantic panoramas of your entire event, like Otakon. Imagine a navigable street view map of the interior of Otakon at like noon.
Okay.
That would be awesome. Mm. And but anyway.
Or like if they could temporarily update something on Google Maps, like embed a map of your convention that weekend, and then when the convention's over, remove it. Or like temporarily, if you're having a concert at a football stadium, which means the seating chart is going to change temporarily, embed the seating chart into Google Maps on the stadium for that weekend during the concert, and then when the concert's over, switch the seat map back to the original football playing seat.
Couple that even further. You couldn't use GPS for this, obviously, but you could use either creatively named access points that were set up ahead of time by Google or some other like similar technology to make a local only location system. Doesn't even have to be that precise, that gives you a map of the convention and a UR hair in the convention, even though it's in some ungodly bunker like the Javits.
Mm.
Anyway. So
I got a news.
I got to finish my point here. I often exclaim to people who don't understand technology that they cannot have privacy, because even if we make laws to protect them, hackers can trivially aggregate extant information that cannot by law be easily hidden. And
if you did hide all the information, you might as well not use computers.
Yep, you'd have too much, like there'd be no more freedom of speech. Imagine if you couldn't tell another person that you saw a certain person on the street wearing a red cap. That's all Google does. Joe was wearing a red cap and he was standing in front of scandals.
All right.
I always try to tell people, you can't get it. You can't get it. Give up. You know, we've got to manage privacy before it's too late, but we can't keep privacy as we currently know it. No one believes me. If you ever run into an old person who doesn't believe that you can just aggregate information like this, show them this article and scare the crap out of them.
They'll just get more scared and do more reactionary stupidity.
Maybe.
Anyway, so Adobe did something today that slightly impressed me, if that's possible.
You know, I rendered.
You're going to complain about your Premiere codec?
I'm going to complain. You know, I recently put up an hour-long panel, Game Mechanics and Mechanism Design.
I actually
and
watched it today. It wasn't that bad, but I keep saying right all the time.
Well,
meanwhile, look at me.
That. Whenever I'm talking, I'm like scooting back and forth, like scoot to the left,
scoot
to the
right.
I also scoot,
but
you
worse,
scoot forward to back.
A worse problem than scooting is me going right. I gotta work on the right.
Well, what I do is when you're talking, I keep touching my nose. That's why I keep zooming in.
What's
on you.
Your nose that you're touching?
I don't know. I just keep like poking at it, pushing my glasses around.
Oh, you got glasses.
Face.
Yeah, that's a situation.
And I think it's because I used to always fiddle with my mustache, but there's no mustache there, so I got to fiddle with something.
Someone's
got to
invent something for glasses that's different in the nose area. I don't know what.
LASIK.
I guess they already have pads of gel in them, right?
LASIK.
So, I mean, how could you do... Anyway.
Anyway.
So Adobe, they came out with a beta of this product called Edge. It's totally free. And actually, it's pretty fascinating. I opened it up, didn't know how to use it, and just started using it. All right? And what it is, an animation tool, and, you know, it does sort of like that in-betweening that Flash does. So you go to time, you go to the timeline, you set it 0 seconds, you put something in the top left corner. You go to 5 seconds, you move it to the bottom right corner, and then you press play, and it'll show you it's sliding from the top left corner to the bottom right corner over the course of the 5 seconds, right? Beautiful, easy to use animation tool, totally awesome.
That'll actually be really useful for making content for panels.
Well, actually, it can only, at the present time, it can only do rectangles, rounded rectangles, and text.
Okay.
Which is like,
Wait a minute, you know what this reminds me of? I'm going to take you way back.
It's a free beta that only works for 150
days. No, what I'm saying, you know how there's Flash and Shockwave and all this stuff? Way back when I bought a multimedia, well, my parents bought a multimedia PC. Mm-hmm. It came with a product called Macromedia, remember Macromedia?
Yeah.
Action.
Okay.
You know what that was? This.
No, it wasn't.
It could do things like this.
No,
though.
you're not finishing, because Flash can do all this animation stuff also. But what this does specifically is not so much about the animation stuff that it does, which Flash already does. It is about its export. It only exports to HTML5.
Oh.
That's all it does.
Oh.
So you save it as HTML5, it gives you CSS, JS, and a div. And you put that div in a web page with those CSS and JS included, and there's your animation.
Oh.
If they added support for audio, you could, and vector arts, you could make a Homestar runner and you'd be all set. But I don't think it does vector arts. I don't think they plan to do that. So I think what it's gonna end up being is just text and boxes and images. So you basically would make web pages.
I have a feeling it'll go a little bit beyond that.
It's gonna be web pages with animations in them that are all smooth and fancy as of right now.
That's pretty chill.
It's actually, the user interface was really good. It didn't crash. It was actually pretty fast for Mac and PC. It's free for 150 days. Some of the stuff is one of these. I looked at all the CSS and JS files it makes. So the files that it makes that are part of your project have no license. So I assume you own them. It does have 2 jQuery files, those are open source, and 2 JS files, one of which is BSD licensed, and one of which you are free to distribute but not to modify. So, So one of the JS files was BSD, and one of them was, but it's like, it's an Adobe product that outputs something
Adobe.
That is almost entirely open source, as opposed to some locked up SWF.
What the
file
hell? They must have gotten like a really good intern or something.
I don't know what the fuck they're smoking, and it works. And it does animate. So this is, it's free for 150 days. Get it now. And maybe make something awesome with it before it becomes $500.
So Adobe, when are you going to support video formats in Premiere?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Let's move on.
So, things of the day. What do you got for me, Scott?
It's a really good video. You know those old videos like, let's go out to the whatever
lobby.
It is.
Lobby. Yeah, let's go out to
that's
the
right.
lobby.
And it was, you know, the dancing popcorn and the dancing raisinets.
I saw one of those that was not ironic at the drive-in when I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we had drive-ins in Michigan.
You know, it's just that little, you know, those little cartoon videos that are sort of, you know, famous. You watch in the movie theater and they're telling you to go out to the concessions to get popcorn, right? And to make you thirsty for Pepsi or some shit.
This is just one of those. You should watch it.
Well, this isn't really one of those.
Well,
it's sort of a take on one of those, right? That is pretty interesting and very professionally well made by MK12. It's called Follow the Sun. Make sure you watch the whole thing.
Yeah, don't stop.
You might get bored. It's like 3 or 4 minutes long. I know you have short internet attention spans, but this is one of those ones where it builds. Trust me, it builds. And it's got sort of a catchy tune, like, let's all go to the snack bar and have a good time. Right? So just keep watching it all the way to the end. I don't know if it's entirely safe for work at the end.
It is not safe for work.
But just watch the whole thing. Trust me. This is great. And
it's
expertly made.
It's no Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But it has a similar, you'll see, it's subtle and then unsubtle.
Yeah, watch it.
It's great. I saw this a while ago, and I forgot about it.
Someone mix it with ponies, because ponies go well with everything.
That'd be a pretty good mix, actually.
Yeah.
Kind of like that to a Ringu mix.
Yeah,
so I got something really simple. This is just The Batman equation for any math nerd who's never seen it.
The Batman equation, which is holy plus something equals
goddamn Batman. No, that would be
the Robin equation.
Kid minus two ex parents plus Joker.
Anyway,
so this is just a fairly large equation that you can graph. It's a fairly, like, it's relatively simple to understand, though I defy anyone who is not insane to look at it and figure out what it graphs just from looking at it without a lot of...
Well, now that they know it's the Batman equation.
Yeah, it's the Batman equation. It turns into Batman, and it's kind of neat.
So basically, you type it into your graphing calculator, and the Bat logo appears.
Yep, this is the kind of thing that you should... have on hand to impress the girls at high school calculus class.
Yeah.
So, meta moment.
Well, it's not going to impress any girls. But on the off chance, that it impresses a girl, that's the one. Don't let her go.
I want, kids, the Rainbow Dash equation.
It's not going to happen.
Might happen. So the meta moment.
Meta moment.
Metamucil.
Book club book is.
Is. All right. The ear, the eye, and the arm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Rim still hasn't uploaded the book club book episode, but it's already recorded.
Yes, it'll be up as soon as I have time. Been busy.
Yeah, so you might actually hear this before hearing the Foundation episode, but we recorded it.
Yes, it's done.
Other metas.
We have a
PAX is coming soon. You can't get tickets.
Yep.
New York Comic Con is coming after that. MAGFest is sometime next year after that.
Yep, we'll be at MAGFest.
We'll be at all three of those, guaranteed. Yep.
We are doing on Saturday at noon in, I forget which theater, I think it's the big one. We're doing Discover the Forgotten Masters, brand new panel.
Don't even know what it's going to be because I haven't written it yet.
No, we haven't, but it involves an Atari 2600.
Yeah, all right.
We have a fancy new Facebook page.
Yeah, you should like us on Facebook. Right now, I'm manually cross-posting things to Facebook, but I've already coded the site to automatically cross-post things to Facebook, and as soon as I launch the new updated site of frontrecruit.com, it will automatically post everything to Facebook, so you won't have to come to Front. I've given up on trying to get people to come to the site at this point. It's pretty much
the
like...
site is basically for, at this point, one, I will occasionally post, like, a link to all the slides from panels.
Yeah, it's like, at this point, it's like, listen, come and find our shit whatever way is most convenient for you. If you're a Facebook person, follow the Facebook page. If you're a Twitter person, follow the Twitter account. Do whatever makes you happy. I give up.
What amazes me is
if you like
how
our
hard
website,
it is,
come to that too.
Is to when I tell people like, yeah, Geek Nights, and they're like, where's your website? I'm like, just Google Geek Nights. It's the first thing. It can't be that hard.
Let me make sure it is.
It is the first thing.
It sure is.
We've been doing this since 2005.
Let me see if it is, if you use Geek Nights as two words and make a mistake. Yep, still number one. All right.
Of course. But we have, you know, we put up one of our PAX lectures from PAX East last year on YouTube in the Geek Nights Rim YouTube channel. I have now uploaded the second of our three panels, a second running of Game Mechanics and Mechanism Design.
I thought it wasn't as good as the first time we did it, but I watched the video today and it was all right, except for me saying right 100 times.
We ran it way better the first time we ran it, but... I was kind of tired when we ran out of PAX East 2011. But the third panel, How to Win at Games, will be up as soon as I have time to edit it together.
And, I forgot we even had a third panel.
Yeah, and keep your eye out because I am rapidly going to add a lot of video content for Geek Nights. Also, you pig fuckers, you know what the first question we got on Game Mechanics and Mechanism Design to YouTube was? Mm-hmm. Guys, where's Radio Free Equestria? I mean,
we
all
made
these
pilots. It's not a regular show. Yeah, we made three pilots.
It's coming. Jesus, you kids.
The regular show is for later.
I love My Little Pony, but Jesus. Really, Jesus.
Maybe when a new season comes.
Yeah, it's supposed to come when it comes.
Right. Video's hard. Any other meta? Merch? Anything?
Hold off on merch.
If there's other meta that we forgot. Worst webcomic contest.
Yes, we have the worst webcomic contest.
Now, if you're going to go to our site, go to the news section, find the post about the worst webcomic contest, and there's going to be a link to a form to fill out. Don't just post in the forum thread, your suggestion. You actually have to go, there's a Google Docs form to fill out your submission for the worst webcomic contest. That is the only place to officially submit where you can win a prize and be considered.
Along those lines, stop submitting. Submitting control alt delete.
We already said that.
Yeah, but I got it.
Okay.
And I got to preface this one last little thing. If you submit an entry to this, you might think this is a little bit of a mean-spirited contest. Yep.
Yep.
So You, if you don't actually create something, are worse than whatever it is that you are submitting. Whoever created that is better than you as a human. So feel
making
bad.
Making something shitty is better than making a really poorly drawn furry porn fanfic where you're the otter in Star Trek.
That guy's better than you.
Is better than someone who makes nothing.
Unless, I mean, if Mike and Jerry, you know, Penny Arcade, if they submit a comic, yeah. Yeah, they can call something shitty.
they can get away with it. They can diss whatever they want. All right, so we already did a show on version control systems.
Yep, and right? We have not done one on change management, but that's more of... It's almost
it's
a
more
Thursday.
More like release management? I mean...
Those are the same thing.
Yeah, anyway. But, you know, Git is one of the few hot new technologies that I am extremely familiar with.
Scott, I would argue, knows more about it than most people at this point.
Well, I think the thing was, is just because at my last job, you know, I was working with a guy who was pretty Linux-y, and he started using Git, like, slightly before it was cool, so I started using it slightly before it was cool.
Yeah, Scott one day was like, hey, so, Git, and I was like, what do you mean? So I use RCS.
I was in the nub stage of Git when other people didn't know it existed, except for really hardcore Linux people. And then when it became popular, I had already sort of mastered the user parts, and by now, I've mastered the underneath parts, which most people don't even know about.
Yep, I mean, I'm currently a nub at Git. I mean, I have a... GitHub account that I haven't logged into in a while. And
yeah. So the thing with Git is that it is a version control system just like Subversion or whatever, except it is architecturally different in that it is distributed, right? There is no canonical, this repository is the repository. Instead, every repository is the full repository. So you have it on your computer, you clone. You don't check out, you clone. You have the whole thing, the whole history of the project on your computer. You edit that history, and then you share commits with other people in a distributed mesh fashion. And that, you know, that way anyone can do as they please, right? And this has many benefits and, you know, drawbacks, but mostly benefits. Once you understand it and use it properly, you'll see that Subversion and other centralized version control systems are just awful. There is some competitors. The chief among them is Mercurial, which is written entirely in Python. You know, there's all sorts of arguments to be made. Is one better? Is one worse? The general consensus, Mercurial is a little easier to use. Git has slightly better performance. They have a lot of feature parity. It doesn't really matter that much, but it seems that Git has won. You know, GitHub has destroyed Bitbucket. So... I mean, Bitbucket still exists, but GitHub is definitely winning. GitHub is sort of the way of the future. If you're not using Git now, you should learn it, because if you're doing anything with software, that's where it's at, and such.
All right. So, I mean, what are the primary benefits for getting the architecture that I doubt many of our listeners will know much about?
Well, the primary benefits of distributed...
If you can tell, I don't know a lot about Git.
Well, do you want me? I can start from like the bottom up if you want, but I might be a little boring.
Now,
maybe later. Let's start.
You know what? The listeners always want. They're always like, well, the listener always wants us to go in depth at our own level and to not like pull back from our level of technological prowess.
Okay, so here's how Git works.
Let's talk about this the way we talk about this stuff.
Okay, so here's how Git works. Yeah. You ready? You have a file.
Yep.
You hash the file with SHA, very strong hash, very unique, right?
Yep.
So what you do is you take a file, you hash it. You create what's called a blob in Git terminology, right? So that blob contains the contents of the file compressed and whatever, right? And the name of that blob will be the hash, the SHA-1 hash.
Uh-huh.
You update the you update the file, you update the blob. It's that simple, right? So you create a new repository. In that repository, you have some files. You add them all to what's known as the staging area, the index, right? So basically, this is advantage number one of Git, is the index. Most you know, things like Subversion, you edit files and you commit, and it commits all your changes, no matter what files they are, right? So if you, say, want to have two files that are edited, and you want to commit one file and not the other, you have to actually roll one of the files back, commit, and then roll the file forward, right? Yep. It's sort of annoying. In Git, you actually add your changes to the staging area, the index, and then when you commit, the index is what is committed, right? So you can actually, if you do an interactive add, you can actually add part of a file. So if I edit a file and I change two functions, I can actually add one of those changes to one of the functions to be committed and let the other one just stay as a dirty change.
Wow.
It's pretty crazy. So you stage and then you commit, right? So that's the first advantage of Git, just from the user perspective, right? So anyway, under the hood, right, it's making blobs. So everything is uniquely hashed, which means that whatever you put into Git is what you're going to get out. A lot of other version control systems don't actually guarantee that what you put in is what you get out. With Git, whatever you put in, guaranteed to get out, because if the hash don't match, it ain't going to fly. Right?
All
right. So a commit in Git is what's known as a tree. It's a tree. And that tree is a list. And the list is a list of trees and blobs. That's all it is. It's trees and blobs. So a tree would be the top level of your repository, which would be your commit.
Yeah.
And then underneath that would be trees, which would be the subdirectories. And in those subdirectories would be blobs. And when you commit, it just creates a new tree with the new blobs and the new trees in it.
So when I've pulled out, like I've brought down the repository or whatever, I basically got the entire, everything in the project just local.
You have the entire history of every commit that has ever been.
So I could step back through to the hello world of the project.
You absolutely could.
All right.
You wouldn't even have to step. You would just reset to it.
Does this cause disk space issues ever for people?
Or it does. It is highly compressed and incredibly efficient.
I guess, does anyone use Git for the management of things that aren't code, like large images or video or anything that?
Oh, it's actually incredibly efficient at doing those things.
Really?
You are going to obviously have to use a lot of disk space.
Yeah, but if I'm doing video, I have to use a lot of disk space anyway.
It is better at that than the other version control systems are.
Well, I found that
it will not crash under the weight. Git was originally going to be a file system. So, if you have 10,
I did not know that.
If you have 10 1 gig video files, sure, it's going to be a 10 gig download. But
yeah, but that's expected. It was going to be 10 gigs if I use Subversion.
Yeah, but switching between versions is basically instantaneous. Once you've downloaded it, you're all set. The performance of Git is off the chart.
Well, considering that local disk space is effectively infinite in the modern world,
Yeah, Git is actually really useful for things other than code, just because it's so good. If you go to GitHub, all the wikis on GitHub are actually powered by Git. And I've actually figured out a way to do wiki show notes on our site powered by Git.
Ooh, we kind of need that.
It's pretty crazy once you see how it works. It's intense. All right, so where was I? You're like, oh yeah, can Git be used for? Yeah, you can use Git for anything you want a version. Writing a book, Git's a great idea. Anything that you need to basically have another level of undoing and versions on, Git is a great way to go.
Hmm.
So you make these commits, and every commit is a tree, and every commit has a hash of its own, right? So that's an easy way to identify a commit is by its hash. And a commit also has one other thing, which is a pointer to the previous commit in the history, right? So commit number one points at nothing, but commit number two points at commit number one. And every commit is a full tree full of trees and blobs. So the main thing here that this allows you to do that other version control systems don't allow you to do is easy branching, right? In Subversion, making a branch is a big deal. You've got one shared repository. If you make a branch, that's a branch for everyone, not just you. Right? And it's a big deal to make a branch. And then to merge a branch, forget it. Kill yourself. Right?
I've never done it. I've given up.
People who have mastered it and can get it done with a minimum of pain. But if you do Git properly, you can always avoid the pain. Right? So you can just branch like a nut job. Right? You can just be like, oh, yeah, I'll make a branch over here and a branch over there. And what I tend to do, which is a good best practice, that's another thing people can get confused about Git, is that other version control systems, because they're so limited, there's only one workflow you can follow if you want to use them. But Git lets you do anything, which means it's like, what workflow do I have? You have to make up a workflow, and you have to enforce that workflow with just people and talking to each other.
I imagine that's very difficult for many people.
There's no technological enforcement of the workflow, but there are certain practices that will sort of grease the wheels. So it's like you have to simultaneously know the path to follow to grease the wheels to have less conflicts and merge problems, while simultaneously getting people to behave in a certain way so that, everything runs smoothly.
It is, however, I think in the long run, a more fruitful path than, say, ticketing systems are an example of this, where you need to enforce certain workflows. And the only way people ever do it is to make rules like a ticket cannot be set to a resolved state unless X, Y, and Z have already happened to the ticket.
Yeah,
you cannot
set it to
assign unless it actually has an assignee. Because you can't. And the thing is, once you go down that path, you can't trust people for shit. Because if there is any way to do the thing you don't want them to do, they will do it. And in their mind, it's okay because they'll let them do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the difference between a ride with a car where you're on a rail, so no matter what way you turn, the car goes the straight way anyway, versus an F1 car. If you turn off the track, you just die.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Because Git is distributed, right? Subversion, a commit in Subversion actually pushes your code to the central repository if there's a bunch of people working on the project together, which means one person can just commit and fuck the whole thing up. In Git, everyone's working locally with their own copy of the repository, and they're only sharing when they explicitly share. So committing, making checkpoints for, you know, to reset and roll forward and back for your code is completely independent of sharing code. So you can make checkpoints to make your life easier locally without sharing those checkpoints with anyone. Hmm. So that greatly reduces any chance of fucking things up. Right at the get-go.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine with, like, the Subversion I used to use at another company, like, pulling the repository down to my laptop, working on stuff for a week, like, on a trip or something, coming back to work and trying to put that back in.
Well, that's another thing, right? Subversion, you only get the most current version of the code when you check out, which you can't work if you're not online, if you're not connected. Git, you have the whole thing. You can work completely offline. You know, it doesn't matter where you are.
Oh, but in Subversion, I could pull down what I'm working on and lock it for everyone else.
You could do that. Yeah, there's no locking in Git, right? So when you do want to share something, right, there's a whole bunch of different ways to do it. You could share by email if you freaking want to. You could give someone a GZ file on a stick if you want to, right? You can do whatever. But generally, people tend to do things in two ways. You could set up a communally agreed upon central repository and push to it, right? So push would be a separate command, and you would just send your commits to that, you know, repository on whatever branch you wanted to send them onto, and then other people would pull them, and you would all be disciplined, and no one would mess it up. That's what we do at work, but it breaks down when you have too many people, right? So when you have too many people, like you do, say, on Linux, what you do is you do a pull request, which is you email someone or call them on the phone or say hi and you talk to them and you say...
That's quite a difficult protocol for many developers.
I know. And you say, look, my repository is over in this place and I have some commits on it that I would like to submit for your consideration. Please pull from my repository. Right? And this is how GitHub works, is GitHub has pull requests. So if you go on GitHub, you clone someone's project, you do some work on it, you finish it, you push your code back to GitHub from your local... Right, so you push it from your local to your GitHub, then you do a pull request telling the other guy to pull your GitHub into his GitHub. You see how it's like everyone has all these different copies of it?
Yep.
So he gets a pull request notification on GitHub. He takes your code from your GitHub to his local machine, hopefully, puts it on a separate branch where it won't mess anything up, checks your code out, sees how good it is, sees if it's working, merges it in with his code, sees how that works. If he likes your code, then he'll merge it in and push it to his repository, thereby accepting your pull request. If he doesn't like your code, he'll just throw that branch away and give you the finger and ignore you.
All right.
But the thing is, your code isn't lost. You still have it, right? If you like your thing a different way than he likes it, then you maintain your own branch. Good for you. You forked it. Congratulations.
So how does it handle merging? Like if two people have edited, like you're trying to merge two branches where the fundamental difference is like one section of code is just like two people implemented it way differently.
Okay, so Git merges are pretty complex here, but they're also the most powerful and the best, right? So here's how it works. Remember I told you a commit is just a tree that has trees and blobs under it.
Yep.
Right? So I want to merge two branches together. Right, so I take these two branches, and all it looks at really is the top commits, because a branch is just a pointer to a commit. That's all it is. And it just so happens that if you are on a branch and you commit, it automatically moves the branch pointer ahead to the new commit. That's all it does. So a branch is just a pointer, an easy way to specify a commit. So I might say master. Well, master is currently pointing at this commit, so master is just an easy way of saying that commit. Right, and head is just an easy way of saying the commit I'm currently looking at. So head is just a pointer that looks at the commit you're currently looking at. And if you make a new commit, head and the branch you're on get moved forward to point at the new, right? They're all just all these names are just pointers to commits. So if I merge, let's say I have a production branch and I go to the production branch and I say git merge master, right? Which would take the commit of the master branch and merge it with the production branch, right? What happens is it takes the top, it takes production, which remember is just a commit.
Yeah.
It takes master, which again is just a commit. And then it looks at their histories and it rolls back to find the common ancestor. And it doesn't care about any of the commits in between. All it cares about is the two commits you're merging and the common ancestor. So then it looks at each blob in both commits. So let's say that all that's in there is a readme.txt and some other 5 readme.texts. So it looks at the first readme.text and it says, all right, this readme.text, I'm production branch. Was there any difference between this readme.text between production and the common ancestor? No. Okay. Well, was there any difference between this readme.text between master and the common ancestor? Well, yes. Yes, there was a change. So in the master branch, this file changed. Yep. But in the production branch, it did not change. Nope. We're just going to take that master change, aren't we? That easy merge. Just take the master. Done.
Uh-huh.
Easy.
So what if the two readmes diverged?
Ah, so both in the case where both readme files have changed, there were edits on production and there were edits on master. Well, were they the same edits? Exactly the same? Because that case, we're just, right?
Yeah, well, I'm assuming no, because that's the more interesting case.
So no, they're not the same. There were some edits on the production branch and there were some edits on the master branch that were different. Well, are these edits like on the same line? You know, it has actually a bunch of different merge algorithms it uses that it tries, all right? So let's say one of the things added a commit at the top of the file and one of the things added a comment at the bottom of the file. It'll just merge them together, no problem.
Uh-huh.
All right? But let's say two people edited the same function, the same line of code is two different lines, right? Since the common ancestor. It'll say, dude, conflict, yo. And what you'll have to do is you have to open up the file and you'll look through the file and you see a bunch of chevrons and it'll basically say, hey, dude, look, this line on the production branch looks like this and on the master branch looks like this. Manually edit me. So you manually edit that one area of the file, remove all the chevrons and all the extra crap it threw in there, right? Get the file just the way you want it to look post-merge, add it to the staging, to the index, the staging index, and commit, and then it'll be merged.
Nice. And of course, it keeps the versions of everything along the way because it's Git.
Yeah, of course. Right? So, you know, there's no way you could possibly lose anything unless you intentionally try to lose something. And even if you do lose something, like you accidentally like remove something, you could actually check the Git ref log and bring it back. Because unless the garbage cleaner has come along, it won't actually be gone. Which is really, the Git ref log has saved my ass quite a few times, let me tell you. So yeah, merge is pretty fancy like that. The other thing about Git that's incredibly powerful is the rebase. A lot of people, if you look online, they'll be like, don't use rebase. That's a naughty thing to do. They're totally wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. There's a reason the tool's in there. They wouldn't have made it if you weren't supposed to use it. Linus Torvalds wouldn't have made rebase if you weren't supposed to use rebase. All right. So what rebase does is it basically rewrites history. It rebases. So say, for example, I start working on a new feature. I'm going to add to the website the ability to post on Facebook. So I make a branch called the Facebook branch, and I start working on it. Meanwhile, you add the ability to post to Twitter, right? And you finish. And now you put it on the master branch. So I forked the master branch and to add my Facebook feature, but your Twitter feature is now on the master branch, but it's not in my Facebook branch. But it needs to be. Right? Because I need to build my stuff, taking your stuff into consideration because you finished your work first. Therefore, I have to get my work to work on top of your work. Right? And I don't want to just try to merge the two together when I'm all done. That Yep. could be painful. It might work, but it could be painful. So what I do is I rebase my branch onto the master branch. What that does is it takes all my commits on my Facebook branch and sort of puts them in a bin on the side. Okay? So now right? And then it takes your commits and it puts them right there, right? Where my Facebook commits just were. So now my branch and master look the same. Then it takes my Facebook commits and it puts them right on top of your Twitter commits on my Facebook branch. So now I've rebased. You see how I picked my stuff up? I made a new base for my stuff, right? Do you understand? You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
All right. Now this also has other fancy powers, and this is where the magic comes in.
The magics.
I'm working on an open source project. Say I'm making a Linux kernel driver. It's hard work. So I make a lot of commits locally, a lot of checkpoint commits. You know, and a lot of these commits are just like fixed a typo, added a line, testing this out. Oh, that didn't work, revert it. You know? And I just keep making tons and tons of commits all locally. And eventually after 10 days and 100 commits, I finish the driver. Right? Now the Linux kernel doesn't want to see 100 commits, right? I can't be like, hey, Linus, pull request, 100 little commits with typos and all this nonsense for this one driver. He'll be like, screw you. I don't want your 100 commits cluttering up the history of the Linux kernel. It's you're basically, you know, as far as you're personally concerned, those 100 commits have meaning. But for him,
it's basically one version, like version 1.0 of this driver.
As far as Linux, the kernel is concerned, it's one commit. That commit should have a message like, added new driver for lousy webcam that only Scott has, right? That's all he wants, one commit with that whole change in it. So what you do is you rebase against yourself. You rebase the branch against itself, and you do an interactive rebase, which is allows you to manually control the rebase. And what you would do is you would actually squash the commits with this rebase into just one commit that you would then share. So that you would it allows you to rewrite the whole history of what you just did on that branch, and then merge just that one really pretty commit back in. So you can make a whole bunch of messy commits all on your own that make it really easy to do your work because you have all these checkpoints. You can roll them back and forward, take them in and out. You can try to a function.
Deepen other people.
You can decide you don't like it, take it out, replace it with something else. You know, and you can have this whole, your whole workflow history is there, you know, to make it really easy to get the job done and try all sorts of stuff out, branches and all sorts of merging and nonsense. But when you're finally said and done, you can rebase everything into one cozy commit that can then be shared with other people that is clean and beautiful, and no one will see all that mess you made when you were working locally. But you do, and you still have that history. It doesn't go anywhere. It's hidden inside. So you can always go back to it if you need to. You know, oh, adding that one line was a mistake. I'll just go and find that, you know, commit that got rebased in, revert it, and make a new commit and all that.
That makes
nonsense.
A lot of sense in light of, like, go back to my video example. Say I wanted to use that for, like, video collaboration. Well, I have 1,001 gigabyte commits of this video, and the project manager doesn't want 1,000 gigabytes of crap. They want the final one.
Yeah, I'm not sure how exactly. I haven't done a lot with binary files so much in Git, at least not big ones.
Yeah, I don't know either.
So I'm not sure if it only stores the diffs of the binary files or if it actually stores the whole files.
That diffs of binary files are often
but
suboptimal.
The thing is, even though it will be exceptionally good at performance of saving space and being very fast at executing commands, don't fool yourself. You know, with Subversion, when you check something out, you are only checking out the newest version.
Yep.
So it's a pretty quick download. If you try to clone the Linux kernel and get the complete history from Git, it takes a long time to download, because even though it's mostly just code, in fact, it's almost all code, there's a lot of it, and the history is long. It takes a long time to download that. It's a big package. Don't fool yourself. So if you consider download time to be incredibly important, that is a negative. It's there. There are tons and tons of fancy things. I can go on for like hours talking about like Git bisect, and which like you with Git bisect, I won't tell you how it works, but what it does is let's say you have a bug and you don't know when the bug appeared. You tell it the last known good commit, and it will roll forward one commit at a time, asking you, is this commit good? Yes, no. Yes,
so I
no.
could run that through a regression tester that regression tests every commit until it hits the one that fails the test, and then I know someone fucked it up.
That's you know which commit introduced the problem. And yeah, you can run it through an automatic testing system that will automatically mark the commits as good or bad. So it'll automatically just be like, oh, this is the bad commit. This is where the problem came from. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It can do all sorts of crazy shit. There's like hooks. So you'd be like, here's a shell script. Whenever anyone commits, automatically execute this shell script. Whenever anyone pushes, execute this shell script. So you can have like your Git repository email everyone when there's a new commit or stuff like that. You can do tagging of releases. You can do bringing tons and tons of ridiculous shit that most you can do. Git blame is really good. It knows who edited every single line and every single file. So you do a git blame when you see a bug and see who exactly introduced that bug because their name is right there on the line. You know who did it. I don't know. It's crazy shit. But if you're, you know, if you've never used version control, or even if you have been using it, or if you're coding anything, even the simplest little project, personal thing just for yourself that might be one file, it's worth it to store it in Git. Even if you're not coding, if you're doing anything where versioning might be a good idea, right? I mean, I know that, like, doesn't Microsoft Word do versioning in itself now?
Yeah, and a lot of people use, like, web dev and stuff to do that sort of thing.
Oh, good God. Yeah, you want to use, if you're doing any work that needs to be versioned, where you want to be able to roll back to old versions, roll to new versions, if you're working collaboratively on something with anyone that is files, especially text files, You want to use Git and you want to learn it. Even if you start out using it just really simply, don't bother with the fancy stuff like rebase and whatever. Just do commits on one branch, push and pull between two people. What, you know, just use GitHub in the simplest way possible. That's okay. You're doing something, and even though you don't know the advanced features, you might need them. And when you do come to need them, you can look them up, how to use them to save your ass. Or you can get someone to help you save your ass. If you're using something else, saving your ass might not be a possibility. And, you know, that's the thing with Git, is it's like, you know, it's the whole hog of Neal Stephenson, right? It's this incredibly powerful drill that you could just fucking kill yourself. It's so powerful. But it can always get the job done. So you could, it can shoot yourself in the foot, but it can also unshoot yourself in the foot. And it's,
of course, with the whole hog, you can't undrill a hole.
That's true. But Git, it's very hard to get to ruin it completely. It might be also really hard to get it back to goodness, but it's possible. Almost always possible to fix anything. And it's definitely possible that no matter what problem you're in, you can escape.
So kids, just remember, it's trees and blobs all the way down.
It is trees and blobs all the way down, pretty much.
This has been Geek Nights with Rim and Scott. Special thanks to DJ Pretzel for the opening music, Kat Lee for web design, and Brando K for the logos.
Be sure to visit our website at frontrowcrew.com for show notes, discussion, news, and more.
Remember, Geek Nights is not one, but four different shows. SciTech Mondays, Gaming Tuesdays, Anime Comic Wednesdays, and Indiscriminate Thursdays.
Geek Nights is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. Geek Nights is recorded live with no studio and no audience. But unlike those other late shows, it's actually recorded at night.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. For more information on the show and how to contribute your own shows, visit hackerpublicradio.org.